my funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart.
Valentine's Day is such a pleasant day and such a pleasant thought. Love, Cupids, chocolates. But 92 years ago today in Chicago, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre shocked the world when Chicago's North Side erupted in gang violence and seven men shot to death by men dressed as police officers. It remains one of the most famous unsolved crimes in American history. And with us to talk about this crime and a little bit about Al Capone is a historian and researcher on the issue, Chris Lyon. She's the author of A Killing in Capone's Background Playground, The Hunt for the Most Dangerous Man Alive. She's appeared in an episode of PBS series, History Detectives, and many documentaries, including National Geographic and Travel Channel. Here's Chris to talk to us about Al Capone and the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Hello. Happy St. Valentine's Day Massacre Day. Valentine's something.
It's like such the opposite, you know, what it should be.
Exactly.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the 1920s in Chicago. Can you set the stage for what the climate was like, how Al Capone became a person with great power in the city of Chicago, and how we led up to the massacre?
Well, one of the major things that we needed to have to even have an Al Capone or even a gangster was the idea of prohibition that came about in 1920. And this was also known as the Volstead Act. And in 1920, it was a federal law that basically prohibited the use, sale, manufacture, transport of alcohol, anything you could do with alcohol, they banned it. And this was a well-intended, but it was a really horrible idea that actually created what we now know as a gangster, because the desire for alcohol was still there, and men like Al Capone were ready to provide it. And within the larger cities, they had turfs set up by the gangs, so they had areas where they would operate, and by the mid-20s, there was organized gangs such as the Northside Gang, or the Northsiders, led by George Bugs Moran, and then the Southside Gang, which also is known as the Outfit, that was led by Al Capone, and they were running all the alcohol and other illegal operations in the city at that time.
So Al Capone, he wasn't from Chicago, contrary to what a lot of people believe. What was basically his background and how he sort of came into power?
Well, you know, he was a really great guy as far as being able to have a sense of business. He was from Brooklyn, and he decided to come as an invitation from the previous outfit leadership to come to Chicago and set up. And he quickly rose through the ranks. And by the time he became the leader, he was very young. It was in the mid-20s. But he had really made an impression on people, and he really had a business sense that a lot of people probably don't want to really understand that he did have a sense of business that, it's hard to explain it in a term of a gangster, but yes, he did. He was a guy with that kind of sense and knowledge.
Well, and, you know, just flash ahead to today's, you hear about some of these gangsters in the gangs who are selling drugs and making all this money, and El Chapos and these kinds of people. And you have to know that these people are not stupid. And to make the amount of money that they're making, and I hear that Al Capone was he making $60 million a year back then? I mean, that's an insane amount of money.
You know, definitely, in different dollar terms, yes, it was definitely there. But
well, and you know, so you have to say to yourself, as I say about the gangsters in Chicago, if you could only apply that business sense and that discipline and that perseverance to a legal, and I say a legal endeavor, this would, you know, think about how much money you could make. But that's just not the nature of being a gangster, I guess.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit. I mean, you've studied him a lot and you've read a lot, and you probably even feel like you got to know him a little bit with all the studying that you did. But what kind of guy was he? How did he present himself to the average person, and how did that help him you know, be successful in his criminal life?
Well, the mere fact that we are still talking about him today is really a testament to how influential he was in defining this era that was known as Prohibition in the Roaring Twenties. But he was very smart, and like I said, you know, he had a business sense. I think he also had a sense of public relations when it came to running the outfit, and he believed, you know, that he was providing a service to the people that the government had taken away, essentially. And so he filled that gap. And he certainly wouldn't have been so powerful if the demand wasn't there. You know, he did truly represent Chicago up even today. And people all over the world, like you said before, they know his name and they connect him to Chicago immediately.
And, you know, you and I, Chris, had talked a little bit about this in a pre-interview. And I, you know, I'm an Italian-American, and I really have always resented the glorification of the mob and the glorification of some of these mobsters, the Giancanas and Spilatros and all of those people. And I see that in the movies, that I think there's some glorification of that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But you know... He was a bad man. He did bad things. I mean, he may have been a personable person to meet and shake your hand, but he was doing really bad things, right? I mean,
yeah, and he was, you know, like he was the leader of it. So a lot of the times when people, you know, think that he's the one out doing the deed, you know, he was like the CEO of the company that, you know, is running it. He's having his lower echelon do it. He's having a lot of his lieutenants take care of business. He's running things while he's ordering hits and ordering certain people to be taken down and ordering, you know, keeping his business running. You know, essentially, it's just like I said, with like a regular business.
So let's talk a little bit. If anyone has any questions for Chris, feel free to give us a call here, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're talking to Chris Lyon, who is the author of A Killing in Capone's Playground, The Hunt for the Most Dangerous Man Alive. Let's set the scene for the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago. First of all, where was it?
Well, it was at 2122 North Clark Street, which is in Lincoln Park. And one of the things that was interesting that with this is that George Bugs Moran, he was the leader of the Northside Gang, and he was essentially Al Capone's nemesis. And located at that location was the SMC Cartage Company at the time, and it was a small garage. Literally, it was 27 feet by 120 feet.
Hmm.
You can imagine that. Very, very slim building. But it acted as a front for some of the booze distributions from the Northsiders. And after, you know, Capone had had a couple of close calls with him, the outfit, you know, really wanted to take revenge on Bugs. And so they set up a shipment of whiskey to be delivered to the garage, knowing that Bugs Moran would likely be there to receive it and inspect it. And Capone had a plan, but it didn't quite go as expected.
So this was, and we pretty much know this is the case. We you know, no one was ever convicted of it, but we know that Capone probably orchestrated it. And for some reason, Moran wasn't there. He missed that massacre by minutes, right?
Yes, and the actual event, which we know was the massacre, it really wasn't necessarily planned to be on Valentine's Day. It just happened to be Valentine's Day when it happened, but it was meant to appear as a raid on the garage. So instead of using local gang members who Moran's crew in the garage are likely going to recognize, most historians have theorized that Capone hired out-of-towners. And these are known as the American Boys. And these guys were literally hitmen from St. Louis. And they would dress up as police officers, drive up in a fake police vehicle, and give the appearance of an actual raid going down. And at the time, there would be seven men inside the garage. And unfortunately, the lookouts across the street who were part of this group believed that one of the men that was entering the building was Bugs Moran. So they signaled, you know, this whole incident to go down, but it wasn't the case. Moran was actually running late that day. So once the men inside the garage were shook down and they were ordered basically to turn around and line up against the wall, and history was made from that point. But now one of the men was Frank Guzenberg, and he did survive for a couple hours. He was taken to the Alexson Brothers Hospital that was on West Belden afterwards, and police were able to get to him before he died and asked him, you know, basically, hey, who shot you, Frank? You know, here he's laying in a bed full of bullet holes, and his response was, no one shot me. I'm not a rat.
Let's take a break right here. And let's come back and talk about why it was that the St. Valentine's Day massacre was never solved. No one was ever prosecuted for it. And if this happened today, would that be a little bit different? We're here listening to the Karen Conti Show on Valentine's Day on WGN. We're talking to Chris Lyon, who wrote a book about the St. Valentine's Day massacre and Al Capone. If you have any questions, 312-981-7200. Chris, you have a connection to this crime that's really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the guns, the famous submachine guns that were used in the massacre, how they were found, and how it is that you came to be able to shoot them yourself.
Yes. Oh, this is such a wonderful story. And this is kind of the basis of my book, essentially, is what happened after the massacre. And, you know, as witnesses and the possible suspects fled the city after the massacre, there was one suspect in particular that took up residency right here in southwestern Michigan, where I'm from, and in the small town of Stevensville. And it turns out that there was a lot of other gangsters from the outfit that were also living in southwestern Michigan. And that's why it was kind of considered a playground, because they didn't conduct any business. It was just strictly for fun. But massacre suspect, one of them was named Fred Killer Burke. And he went by the alias name of Fred Dane when he moved to this new residence in Stevensville. And it was, he just continued on doing his normal thing. He kept his nose clean, no issues with him. But exactly 10 months after the massacre, so this would have been December 14th of 1929, Fred got a little bit too much wine in him, a little too much celebration, and he actually got into an accident and had a run-in with us. With the local police officer from St. Joseph's Police Department in Michigan. His name was Charles Skelly. So at that time, Burke, you know, had really two choices, either cooperate or shoot the officer. And in his, you know, state of mind, he made the wrong choice, and he shot the officer dead right in the main intersection of town, rather than face, you know, his recognition. So this led other officers that chased after him after he crashed his vehicle just down the street. Fred somehow escaped on foot, but officers found a receipt in his vehicle that had the address of this location in Stevensville. And when they got there, they found an arsenal of weaponry. It included two Thompson submachine guns and ammo that actually matched exactly what was found in the garage on Clark Street. And so the guns at that time, we knew that Chicago was looking for a couple of Thompsons from this massacre. And the detectives from the Berrien County Sheriff's Department took them over to a guy who was studying ballistics at the time named Calvin Goddard. This was a new science. This hadn't really been used before. But when he inspected them, he determined that the guns were an exact match. And the bullets also matched what was found at the garage. And then fingerprints in the home revealed exactly who Fred Dane really was. He was Fred Killer Burke. And so not only was he a cop killer, but he was also connected to the St. Valentine's Day massacre. And the guns are still in the Berrien County Sheriff's Department's custody because they are considered evidence of a crime.
So these guns, which I imagine are collector's items, and somebody would love to, whether a museum or a private collector, would love to have them, right?
Yes, and there have been many people have offered to pay millions of dollars for these guns, and collectors, lots of museums want them on display, but they are not for sale. And the reason is because they are actually considered evidence in a crime that's never been solved. You know, and like you said, 92 years ago, this crime occurred. But if they were ever to take these guns off of the books as being evidence, these guns are historic and they are fully automatic weapons and they would have to be destroyed. And that's the law. And, of course, nothing like that would ever happen. We would never allow that to happen. But I have been fortunate enough because of my book and being able to study it, also being a retired now employee of the Bering County Sheriff's Department, been able to shoot the guns. And I can tell you that there is nothing that even compares to knowing what these guns did, but the fact that they are now in custody and that will never kill again gives me great satisfaction.
Interesting. So here we have, we find the guns, and the guns match, the bullets match what happened at the massacre. And the guy, his nickname is Killer, so that's not a good sign for him, right? He's killed a cop for no good reason. So why is it that the crime is not solved? Why is it that we couldn't tie this guy, Burke, to that crime? I assume he was questioned, probably strong-arm questioned, quite a bit about his involvement, and did he ever confess to anything?
Well, he did escape, and now this is the escape route. We know up until a certain point, we think a lot of people say, oh, he was going to go back to Chicago, but no, he would not have gone back to Chicago because Al Capone would have had his head. So what he ended up doing is he escaped to Green City, Missouri, which is literally a dirt road and a cross street. That's about it. And he lived down there for about a year and a half. But a amateur detective noticed that he didn't look like a typical farmer. You know, he didn't look like somebody from the area. And so eventually he was caught and they found him. And the first thing that Fred Burke said is, are you the police? And they said, yes. And he said, show me your badges. And they had to show him badges. He says, phew, you know, thank goodness. He was actually relieved to be caught. And he was caught, and at that time, there was an issue with extradition, you know, bringing who was going to get him? And he was down in Missouri, and the governor of Missouri was the one who decided Chicago wants them for the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Michigan wants them for the murder of a police officer. Lots of states wanted him. But he said, I'm going to give him to the state that has the best case that will get him locked up. And it was obvious that Michigan had the best case. Chicago, I know everybody will say, Chicago says we stole him from them, from you guys. But that's not the case at all. We had the evidence. Chicago, you had dead witnesses that left town, nobody willing to talk, which was typical of that era of gangsters. But here in Michigan, we had hundreds of people on the street that saw this happen, saw the officer get shot and killed, and ID'd him, found the guns in his house. So the guns were technically what have been used as evidence in Chicago's case were actually our guns in Berrien County.
And interestingly, you know, it's not unusual for a person to be tried in one venue and convicted and then tried in another venue for another crime, and sometimes two or three venues, as we've seen maybe with R. Kelly being charged in four different venues. Yeah. So I still am surprised that they didn't try him for this crime, because unsolved crimes are not popular things when you're a prosecutor or the police department. And I'm still surprised. Do you think, I mean, from what you know and from the evidence that you know, do you think he would have been convicted had he been tried in Chicago, or was there just not enough evidence?
I don't think there was enough evidence, and I don't think any witnesses would have come forward. Because they literally were scared to death, and because one of the things that was different about Michigan and Illinois back then was Illinois had the death penalty. So there would have been maybe a little bit higher element to prove in that case. And, you know, when you look at it, just having guns in your house, you know, I guess you might maybe determine that as circumstantial, but I look at that as from a layman's, you know, perspective. Is that pretty much sums it up, that he's got the guns that were in the mask, or how else would they have ended up in his house? So he was actually wanted to come back to Michigan. When asked when he was going to be sentenced, he actually got sentenced for second-degree murder because he was drunk at the time. So the judge gave him that. But he was given a life sentence and no death penalty, and he was in retirement mode. He literally was grateful. He said, I don't have to run, I don't have to hide, I don't have to commit any more crimes. I can relax now, get 3 squares a day, exercise, and do everything. But this was all, he was taken up to Marquette Prison up in the Upper Peninsula, and up on literally on Lake Superior, so you couldn't really get any further away from Chicago or Detroit than up in Marquette.
I have like 2 seconds here, and I want to plug your book and give your information. But how did it go down? If you were a betting person, who called up? Al Capone was in charge of it. He calls up this guy, Burke. He gets his friends. How does this all go down in 10 seconds?
Well, Burke was a machine gunner, and Capone found out that he was an excellent shot and hired him. And this was how it went down. And then I believe his friend Gus Winkler, he was an ambulance driver in World War I, which made him an excellent getaway driver. So those two I can absolutely say without a doubt that were involved. Now there's questions about some of the others, but I will let everybody read the book and see if they can figure it out themselves.
A Killing in Capone's Playground, The Hunt for the Most Dangerous Man Alive by Chris Lyon. Where can people pick up your book, Chris?
Well, my book is available online. If you want to get it, my publisher is In Depth Editions, Inc., and also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your favorite bookstore online. And also, hopefully, in some museums once we open back up and get that rolling again.
Thank you, Chris Lyon. Thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge about this really fascinating crime. Take care and happy Valentine's Day to you.
Yes, happy Valentine's Day. Thank you for having me, Kim.
All right, take care.